Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your Sun Sounds volunteer reader, presenting the major news articles from the Monday, August 3rd, 2026 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's check out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather: partly cloudy, early followed by scattered thunderstorms this afternoon. Storms could contain damaging winds, highs around 105 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west at 10 to 20 miles per hour, and chance of rain 40%. Tonight's weather: cloudy skies. This evening will become partly cloudy after midnight. A stray shower or thunderstorm is possible, lows to 81 degrees Fahrenheit, winds south-southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts, except for a few afternoon clouds, mainly sunny. A stray afternoon thunderstorm is possible, highs 103 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Now from the Arizona Daily Star front page, the first article is titled, Trump Renews Blanche Push. This article was written by Emily R. Condon of USA Today. In the latest public spat between President Donald Trump and two Republican senators, the president offered a new threat: approve Todd Blanche as Attorney General or the anti-weaponized fund returns. It will immediately be back on the table and I will get it done, Trump wrote in an August 1st, a Truth Social post, which says Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche, who is also Trump's former personal lawyer, would stay in his acting rank and bring back the fund if not confirmed. Senators Tom Tillis and John Kernan are stalling the confirmation amid questions about Trump's anti-weaponization fund. The $1.776 billion Department of Justice fund that would offer taxpayer dollars to individuals who say they are victims of political backlash and legal challenges. Blanche helped settle the lawsuit between Trump and his own Internal Revenue Service, which created it. And on Friday, July 31st, the president appealed a ruling that blocked access to the fund. Trump said in his new post that the fund takes care of those who have been so badly treated by the crooked Joe Biden and Obama administration, but Tillis responded in the post that it is a payout pot for punks. Critics of the fund see it as a way for Trump's political allies and those pardoned for the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol to cash in on taxpayer dollars. It's unfortunate that Todd Blanche, who I consider qualified for the job, will not be confirmed because of this reversal, Tillis wrote. Hopefully we can resolve this by Tuesday. On Tuesday, August 4th, the Senate Judiciary Committee, which Tillis and Cornyn are members of, will meet to potentially move Blanche's nomination as Attorney General for confirmation before the entire Senate. Earlier this week, Senate Judiciary Chair Chuck Grassley canceled a Thursday, July 30th meeting to move Blanche along for the Attorney General, the post which has been vacant since Trump fired former Attorney General Pam Bondi in April. The president has been back and forth on demands. On July 30th, Trump weighed pulling Blanche's nomination until Tillis, who is not running for re-election, and Cornyn, who lost a Trump-backed Republican challenger in the primary, are out of the office in a few months. The next day, July 31st, Trump called on the two senators to immediately confirm Blanche, and he filed his appeal to reopen access to the fund. Earlier that day, at his Camp David cabinet meeting, Trump said the anti-weaponization fund was dead, but I wish it weren't. The next front page article is titled, Thousands Arrested After Child Migrant Agency Tips. This article was written by Christina Cook of Reuters. Aurora's six-year-old daughter arrived at the U.S. border alone and spent more than half a year in a child migrant shelter while her mother, who was already in the country, worked to get her out. The two were finally reunited in late March. We were overjoyed, said Aurora, 24, who, like others in this story, spoke on the condition they be identified only by their first names. Days later, however, mother and daughter were detained by immigration and customs enforcement and sent to a family detention center in Texas, records show. They are among more than 12,000 people arrested by U.S. immigration authorities following tips from the Office of Refugee Resettlement during President Donald Trump's second term according to internal government data reviewed exclusively by Reuters. ORR was created in 1980 to resettle refugees fleeing war and persecution. Since the early 2000s, the agency has also been charged with housing unaccompanied migrant children arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border like Aurora's daughter. The care of these children has historically been walled off from immigration enforcement. The 2008 law sought to ensure that they were placed in the least restrictive setting and released from detention as soon as safely possible, regardless of their sponsor's legal status. That meant migrant families could be reunited without fear of being targeted by ICE, even if they were in the country illegally. The Trump administration has taken a drastically different approach. Since January 2025, the data shows ORR has shared more than 460,000 leads with ICE about unaccompanied children, their sponsors, usually parents or other relatives, and additional household members, leaving them vulnerable to detention and deportation. While Reuters and others have reported on the growing cooperation between ORR and ICE, this story is the first to reveal the scale of the information shared for immigration enforcement. Interviews with migrant families, legal advocates, and current and former U.S. officials illustrate the far-reaching implication of this policy shift and its human toll. Jen Smithers, who served as deputy director of ORR during the Biden administration, said safeguards against data sharing with ICE have been completely reversed. They are weaponizing the child welfare program for the purposes of more deportations, she said. In a statement to Reuters, ORR said it plays no role in the apprehension of children, referring questions about immigration enforcement to the Department of Homeland Security, ICE's parent agency. In response to questions from Reuters, DHS said that during Trump's second term, ORR has provided ICE Homeland Security investigations with potential investigative leads as part of an effort to locate unaccompanied children who were placed with unvetted sponsors, including some with criminal records. Aurora entered the United States illegally 2 years ago in search of work and safety. She left her daughter with family in their rural Mexican village, fearing she was too young for the dangerous desert crossing. Aurora found a job as a house cleaner in Mississippi. Last August, she said, a relative brought her daughter to the border and left her to surrender to immigration agents, a common strategy among families seeking reunification. Officials transferred the girl to a migrant children's shelter, and Aurora began the vetting process to get her out. Over the course of 6 months, she provided the agency with reams of documentation, including a DNA test she had no criminal records documents show. Under Trump, the screening process for sponsors now includes a number of extra steps, including requiring fingerprints of all household members. As a consequence, the amount of time unaccompanied children spend in custody has increased from an average of 30 days in fiscal year 2024 to 194 days in June 2026, according to ORR figures. ORR declined to comment on specific cases, but said its increased vetting is meant to shield children from harm. The day before being reunited with her daughter, Aurora said immigration agents visited her at home, asked about the girl, and told her to report to an ICE office the following week. At that appointment, Aurora recounted, agents asked me if I had any problems in the U.S., and I said no, because I haven't done anything wrong. All I do is work. She and her daughter were detained at the appointment records show and sent to a family detention center in Dilley, Texas. They were there for 3 weeks. Upon their release, Aurora was fitted with an ankle monitor and instructed to report for regular check-ins pending the outcome of her immigration court case, records show. DHS confirmed details of Aurora's detention and release, saying she had admitted to being illegally smuggled across the border. While she was inside, her landlord in Mississippi evicted her and threw out her belongings, so mother and daughter headed to California, where a friend offered to put them up. Aurora says she fears they will soon be deported. At night, sometimes her daughter gets up and cries, thinking she is still detained, her mother said. Aurora and her daughter are at least together. Other families have been separated again. Malini and her youngest son fled violence in Guatemala in 2023. They crossed the U.S. border illegally and settled in Texas, where she's cleaned construction sites. Her oldest son, Victor, stayed with family back home when his uncle was killed. He, too, decided to make the journey north and turn himself into U.S. border agents. The title of our next article is Prisons Chief Seek Takeover Delay. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. The head of the state prison system wants a federal judge to give him a little more time to fix problem in its health care system before seizing control. In a new court filing, Ryan Thornell acknowledges that it has been nearly 14 years since inmates filed suit alleging unconstitutional neglect in the physical and mental health care provided at the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. After a series of court orders and fines did not work, Judge Rosalind Silver issued a 200-page order in 2022, finding that the care provided is plainly, grossly inadequate, and that state officials were acting with deliberate indifference to the substantial risk of harm to inmates. And that resulted in an April 2023 injunction directing the state to remedy the problems. But attorney Mary O'Grady, hired by the state to defend Thornell, told the judge she should recognize all that has been done since 2023, including spending more on inmate health care. So now she wants Silva to delay the order she just issued, appointing a receiver to actually take over and run the health care system for the next 5 years. A receiver who was given virtually unlimited rights to make changes to not just staffing, but how the money is spent. That claim of things getting better, however, is drawing derision from Sophie Hart, an attorney for the Prison Law Office, which, along with the American Civil Liberties Union, is representing inmates. She told Silver that the state and Thornell, the handpicked selection of Governor Katie Hobbs to run the system when she took office in 2023, oversell their post-2023 progress. Defendants' own data demonstrate either that defendants still have not allocated sufficient resources, or that those resources are not being managed in such a way to comply with the requirements of the 2023 injunction, Hart said. The evidence of harm was overwhelming and largely unrebutted by defendants. What the state wants, she said, is for Silva to accept Thornell's assurances that things will get better than they are now and that he will do better. They essentially argue that their hope for leadership capacity moving forward is what counts, Hart said. But as described, current leadership has failed to implement the necessary reforms, she said. And their continued promises about what they intend to do in the future are insufficient to leave Thornell in charge of the healthcare system. Ultimately, Hart told the judge, any claims the state will be harmed by wresting control of healthcare from Thornell are outweighed by what will happen if she doesn't. Plaintiffs face the risk of injury up to and including death, harm that is happening now and has been ongoing for over a decade precisely because of defendants' inability to make meaningful improvements to the healthcare program, Hart wrote. The question now for the judge is whether, after all these years, it is too little too late. But there have been no lack of warnings. After the lawsuit was filed in 2012, the state agreed to a settlement to improve care. But federal judges overseeing the case ruled repeatedly, starting in 2014, that mental and physical health care provided to prisoners failed to live up to basic constitutional standards. The judges also twice found the state in contempt and issued multi-million dollar fines. In 2015, state officials entered into a settlement promising to do better. But Silver threw that out in 2021 because of the ADCCR's pervasive material breaches of the agreement. And during a 15-day trial before Silver later that year, attorneys for inmates presented evidence of what they said were repeated and horrific consequences inmates suffered due to poor or inadequate health care. That resulted in the 2022 ruling about grossly inadequate care in the prisons and deliberate indifferences by prison officials, and ultimately the 2023 injunction laying out what the prison system must do to bring care up to constitutional standards. It required the state to overhaul how it provided care to inmates, vastly increasing the number of doctors and nurses to set levels, and provide better access to specialists. Other parts of the injunction included limits on putting inmates in isolation and requirements to treat opioid addiction and hepatitis infections among the inmate population. O'Grady told Silva she should look at all that has been done since 2023. The department has more than doubled its healthcare spending, increased healthcare staffing by more than 50%, opened new healthcare facilities, improved existing facilities, increased access to specialty care, the attorney wrote. She also said the department has increased the capacity for mental health department, ensured that all psychiatrists working for the state are board certified, and established a task force to develop and track suicide prevention efforts. The receivership order largely disregards this process, O'Grady said. Instead, it emphasizes the department's shortcomings regarding compliance. There are places, O'Grady acknowledged, where the agency has fallen short, like complying with a staffing plan set just last year. Still, she said that the improvements that have been made factor against the receiver. But there are some facts working against her arguments, including the unwillingness of state lawmakers to fund what this governor said is necessary. In preparing her budget in January, Hobbs asked for the cash to fund 650 more prison healthcare workers in the new fiscal year that began July 1st to comply with the judge's order to dramatically boost staffing so it could provide constitutionally adequate care to inmates. But the Democratic governor got less than half the money needed to fund those new posts in a budget deal she cut with the Republicans, who control the state House and Senate. That provided the cash to pay for slightly less than 42% of the workers, the judge said, in a 2025 order, are needed. Hart told the judge there is other evidence that, even years after the injunction, the state isn't complying on its own with what it was ordered to do. Yes, she said, it's true that NAFCARE, the private firm contracted to provide inmate care, has filled more of its vacant positions. But Hart pointed out to the judge that one-third of the positions she ordered to be filled still remain vacant. The title of the next article is U.S. Military Bases Delay Cleanup of Toxic Forever Chemicals. This article was written by Austin Fast of USA Today. Director Casey Sixkiller of the Washington Department of Ecology met with the neighbors frustrated by lack of progress on cleaning up PFAS contamination around the Army's Yakima Training Center on August 25, 2025, in East Silla, Washington. PFAS cleanup timelines at over 500 military sites have quietly shifted back since the Pentagon first announced them in 2021. Larger spikes indicate longer delays. It's been almost 5 years since Brandy and Brad Hyatt found out the well at their home next to an Army base in Washington is contaminated with forever chemicals. They started using bottled water for everything from making coffee to rinsing off toothbrushes. The couple even carted their two small children across town to bathe at a gym so they couldn't accidentally swallow contaminated bathwater. The Army installed a filter last year, but the well remains contaminated. The kids will be long grown by the time the military provides a permanent fix, now delayed until after 2042. Hundreds of military bases have been putting off cleanup by toxic PFAS, or pyrant polyfluoroalkyl substances, for years, according to a new USA Today analysis of military records. The latest round of delays, which the Pentagon posted in an obscure corner of its website in May, has pushed some deadlines out decades or removed them altogether. For decades, the military has extinguished fires using foam containing toxic PFAS. These chemicals can then seep into the soil and groundwater, where they persist without breaking down, increasing the chance of certain cancers in people who drink from contaminated wells. The military did not respond to USA Today's request for an estimate of how many people the delays affect, But the tally could easily total tens of thousands of neighbors, considering how many sites have been delayed. The Hyatts, who lived down the street from the U.S. Army's Yakima Training Center, had no idea about the delay in their cleanup until USA Today called them. They don't tell us anything, Brandy Hyatt said. The only clue that anything changed appeared behind a link buried on the Pentagon's website, where it publishes a cleanup timelines for more than 700 military installations. USA Today has compiled those reports, many of them now deleted, going back to 2021, observing at least 1,000 instances where cleanup times changed over the past 5 years without a formal announcement. The latest delays posted in May are the most drastic, averaging a decade. USA Today has gathered the timeline details in this searchable data dashboard. Nearly three-quarters of the sites, over 500, have been delayed at least once, and the delays are growing significantly longer. USA Today's analysis of the now unavailable documents shows from 2021 to 2024, the military delayed cleanup timelines for the new dozen sites each quarter, usually by just a year or two. Timelines at a handful of sites would even speed up, so typically by a year or so. Delays suddenly began to pile up in March 2025, when the Pentagon delayed over 150 sites at once. The newest records released representing cleanup for timelines as of September 2025 delayed target dates for nearly 200 military sites as much as two decades into the future. These timelines don't even represent when each base's neighbor can expect their property to be safe from forever chemicals. When cleaning up environmental contamination, the military follows the multi-step Superfund program laid out by Congress. The timelines the military has been delaying are largely the remedial investigation step, which explores how far pollution has spread and how they might repair the damage. The final cleanup can't even begin until they pass these milestones. These cleanup delays are happening even at military sites where the Pentagon has publicly confirmed forever chemicals are seeping into the local water sources, U.S. Today found. Water testing shows the chemicals can drain off base and contaminate private wells and sources of municipal drinking water. Dayton, Ohio, Fort Worth, Texas, and Tucson, Arizona are just a sampling of the cities that have filed lawsuits against the military claiming PFAS threatens their water sources. USA Today's analysis of available military test results on public and private drinking water shows wells around 73 bases have tested above the current Environmental Protection Agency limit for forever chemicals in drinking water. All but two of these bases have faced delays to their cleanup process, USA Today found. At South Carolina's McIntyre Air National Guard Base, where one-third of water samples have tested above the EPA limit, the cleanup timeline has been delayed nearly a quarter century from 2029 to 2053. About 85% of samples at Biddle Air Base, Air National Guard Base outside Philadelphia, have tested above the EPA limit, but its cleanup has been delayed 19 years. And in Yakima, Washington, cleanup was delayed over 13 years, even though more than 1,350 water samples taken from the Hyatt's neighborhoods around the Army's Yakima Training Center have tested higher than the EPA limit. For Brandy Hyatt, moving into their three-bedroom home on a two-acre lot felt like a dream come true. The couple and their two kids enjoyed a stream running through the backyard and views of snow-capped mountains peaks in the distance, plus the constant convoys of soldiers driving in and out of the base just down the street gave them a sense of security and pride. Until 2021, when the Army knocked on Hyatt's door to test their wells and found PFAS. Since moving in, she said, at least five neighbors have died of cancer and she developed a thyroid condition. This beautiful dream of raising our babies at the end of a sweet cul-de-sac with all these nice old neighbors, Hyatt said, pausing, to find out the dream is potentially killing you, it's just really hard. Dozens of members of Congress have sent letters to the Department of War, formerly the Department of Defense, since last fall to express their concern about the delays. In a letter sent to July 21st, Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington, criticizes not just the delays, but the way they've been happening. Instead of consulting with community leaders and announcing the delays to the public, the department instead chose to quietly remove the previous cleanup schedule from its website and publish new timelines, Murray wrote. This is ultimately a violation of trust between military leaders and their surrounding communities. The Pentagon did not respond to USA Today's request for comment in time for publication. However, an Army spokesperson said schedule changes are a natural part of the environmental cleanup process. They reflect ongoing technical work, not a change in our commitment, wrote Lieutenant Colonel Landon Howard in an email. He described protecting drinking water as a first priority at the Yakima Training Center, adding that base officials maintain regular communication with the state and local community. The Army updated its timeline when it became evident that updated PFAS data evolving U.S. EPA standards and site-specific complexity required the Army to perform additional fieldwork and analysis beyond what the earlier published timeline reflected, Howard wrote. Since the Superfund cleanup process typically takes many years, the military has previously said it's taken interim actions such as providing bottled water or installing filtration systems near at least 55 military bases with the worst contamination. When our data indicates a risk, we act immediately to cut off that exposure path, Howard wrote, noting the Army has installed 71 in-home filtration systems around the Yakima Training Center with plans for dozens more. Plus, they're providing bottled water to many of the highest neighbors still waiting for a filter. Across the country near Philadelphia, officials at the Battle Air National Guard base said the first phase of their investigation is wrapping up. Investigators said more soil and water sampling is required to fill the gaps in their data, but that can't happen until the Air Force awards the base more funding. Meanwhile, its cleanup timeline has been delayed nearly two decades. We've been prioritizing interim actions across the nation, and we're doing it at Biddle, said William Mayer, Biddle's Environmental Restoration Program Manager, at a public meeting held July 16th. We're actively doing a groundwater design to construct the groundwater treatment system. For the first time, the War Department's quarterly update on May 21st included brief footnotes to explain why each base's timeline was extended, including reasons such as the prioritization of higher-risk site, a need for additional testing, and severe weather. The Pentagon has also added a note to its website that while military strives to maintain the original schedules, shifts may occur due to unique factors encountered at some sites. The USA Today obtained some of the military's responses to the dozens of elected officials who have expressed concerns about the delays. The department's response generally echo the Army spokesperson's comments, also blaming tougher EPA regulations and citing factors like funding available and contractor problems. Near Yakima, Washington, it took the Army nearly 4 years to install the highest PFAS system filtration system. It was the uncertainty during this really long, frightening process that prompted Brandy Hyatt to found Pursue PFAS Free, a community group that gathers and shares information and advocates for clean water around the handful of military bases across the state. Everyone deserves to be safe in their homes, she said. I didn't feel safe in my home anymore, and my neighbors didn't. Some of our neighbors still aren't safe years after the contamination was discovered. Craig Caron, who manages hazardous waste cleanup in the region for the state's Ecology Department, points out that the 71 filtration systems the Army has installed to date is just half the count of nearby homes whose wells have tested over the EPA limits. His department wants the Army to be more proactive in testing and mitigating the contamination, so Caron said seeing the unannounced 13-year delay is worrisome. We felt like the 2028 goal was very optimistic, may be too overly optimistic, said Caron, who also was unaware of the delay until USA Today contacted him. But any timeline that's a decade long is troubling. A public review of the cleanup process cannot occur until the military finishes its investigation, Caron added. Until those documents are released, the public really has no insight, no view behind the curtain about what the Army is doing, except for what the Army chooses to share, Caron said. If the Army pushes back those deliverables for a dozen years, then where's the public's opportunity for real participation in this issue that affects them? The Army created a quarterly newsletter and PFAS website in response to criticism about poor communication in Yakima. Other sites like Biddle Air National Guard Base in Pennsylvania have regular meetings of advisory boards that allow neighbors to meet the military officials leading the cleanup. However, Joseph McGrath, who worked for decades at the Naval Air Station adjoining Biddle, said it's not enough. From the day to day, we have no idea what's going on, McGrath told Biddle's restoration manager during the advisory board's July 16th meeting. I don't see anything on an active level. Hyde had stronger words for her interactions with the military. The Army just gaslights everybody, she told USA Today. I love our soldiers, Hyde said, but I don't have nice things to say about the way the Army has communicated with us. She described tense conversation with Army officials, where she felt bullied and blamed for the delays holding up the installation of their home filtration system. The title of the next article is Trump Touts Possible Iran Deal. This article was written by Jasmine Gianna and Mina Alaydin of Reuters. Dateline Cairo. President Donald Trump says the U.S. will hold off on a fresh attack on Iran as long as a deal can be reached quickly to halt Iran's nuclear ambitions and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Trump said late on Saturday in his Truth Social platform that Iran and other Middle Eastern countries had asked for time to complete a deal that would lead to the immediate, complete, and total reopening of the vital strait and Iran and an end to Iran's nuclear threat. He did not name the countries in the post, which followed a call with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, a U.S. ally. Based on this request, I have agreed for the future benefit of the world and likewise the survival of a successful, prosperous Iran to cancel the attack, subject to being able to rapidly make a deal, Trump wrote. Israel joins me in this commitment, he said. Trump's apparent de-escalation after days of threats of new attacks from each side was the latest twist in the war the U.S. and Israel launched 5 months ago. Attacks have spread across the Gulf to the Red Sea and even a Mediterranean facility in Egypt. Iran has largely closed the Strait of Hormuz, a conduit for 20% of the world's oil and LNG before the war, causing energy prices to rise and stoking broader inflation. Eli Cohen, Israel's energy minister and a member of Prime Minister Netanyahu's security cabinet, said there was close scrutiny and security and intelligence coordination between Israel and the U.S. on everything happening in the region. But he added, with or without an agreement and regardless of any external commitments, if Iran attempts to renew its nuclear program or advance its ballistic missile industries, we will be there. We will take action and we will strike. Trump and Netanyahu met on Tuesday in Washington with an Israeli official saying they had explored all possible paths to curb Iran's nuclear program, including diplomacy, economic pressure, and force. Tehran denies seeking a nuclear weapon. Iran's acting defense minister, Brigadier General Mahid Ebn al-Raisa, said Tehran viewed recent U.S. threats as psychological and cognitive warfare, but was treating them seriously, adding that Iran would boost preparedness and deterrence rather than be caught off guard or remain passive, Press TV reported. In his call with Trump, the Saudi Crown Prince stressed the necessity of prioritizing dialogue to de-escalate tensions in the Middle East, according to Saudi Arabia State News Agency. A White House official told Reuters that the two had spoken but did not provide details. At a cabinet meeting on Friday, Trump said he believed U.S. negotiators including his own son-in-law, Jared Kushner, Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, could reach a deal with Iran. As an April ceasefire in the war unraveled past month, benchmark Brent crude futures LCC1 jumped 24%, and analysts polled by Reuters expect prices to rise further this year. Trump has argued that his stated goal of keeping Iran from gaining nuclear weapons justifies higher fuel costs in the near term, but the economic pain has put political pressure on him to find a way to end the war. Adding to the energy industry's concerns, Iran's Houthi allies in Yemen in recent days began threatening the Bab el-Mandeb, the strait at the other end of the Red Sea from the Suez Canal, another export route for Saudi crude. The United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operation said on Saturday it had received reports of two maritime incidents off Oman. In one, an unknown projectile struck a tanker, damaging the engine room. In the other, the master of a tanker reported seeing a large splash and an explosion close to the vessel, though no damage was reported. Now we'll pause to remind you that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The title of the first article is What to Know About Biggs's Running Mate. This article was written by Helen Rummel of the Arizona Republic. Former State Senator Sion Kerr is running alongside Republican gubernatorial candidate Andy Biggs to become Arizona's first ever lieutenant governor. The Buckeye native comes from an expansive background in agriculture. She and her husband ran a dairy farm for more than 40 years in the West Valley District she represented in the state legislature. Kerr will now join Biggs on the campaign trail in hopes of defeating Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs in November. Most recently, Kerr was tapped by the Trump administration to serve as a state executive director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Farm Service Agency in Arizona. Her father is a U.S. Army veteran, and her mother immigrated to the United States from Sonora, Mexico. She and her husband, Bill, have 4 children and 12 grandchildren. Kerr, who was picked to replace a vacant state Senate seat in 2018 after Steve Montenegro ran for Congress. She was reelected 3 times before choosing not to run in 2024. She served in legislature districts 13 and 25, which includes parts of Buckeye, Surprise, and Yuma. Kerr served as the Senate Majority Whip and Chairman of the Natural Resources, Energy, and Water Committee, giving her significant influence over the state's agricultural policies. She was briefly a member of Hobbs' Water Policy Council in 2023 before stepping down over concerns that the group existed to approve progressive policies that she said hurt farmers. During her time in the legislature, Kerr sponsored a bill helping create the Arizona Healthy Forest Initiative, a program that employs inmates to clear debris from the state's forests in hopes of preventing wildfires. She was a prime sponsor of a bill looking to codify several definitions relating to sex and gender in a way that excluded transgender people. The bill, which Kerr dubbed the Arizona Woman's Bill of Rights, was vetoed by Hobbs. In 2021, Kerr introduced legislation that would have made it a felony for a physician to perform an abortion if the fetal heartbeat could be detected. The bill later stalled in the Senate. Before joining the state Senate, Kerr held leadership roles within the Arizona Farm Bureau and the Buckeye Chamber of Commerce. After voters approved the position in 2022, the lieutenant governor serves as next in line to replace the governor. Previously, the Secretary of State would succeed the governor if they cannot perform their duties. The governor can also appoint a lieutenant governor up to head the Department of Administration take on the role of chief of staff, or serve in any other position within the governor's purview. Kerr would likely be picked to lead Arizona's Department of Agriculture, according to Bing's campaign. The title of the next article is Anonymous Critics in Arizona Targeted by Government. This article was written by Taylor Seeley of the Arizona Republic. At least twice in the past 12 months, Arizona political leaders have sought to unmask anonymous online critics. Republican state lawmaker Rachel Keschel in May sought an injunction against harassment similar to a restraining order against the anonymous X account that uses the handle William Coffin. The account repeatedly accused her of unlawfully living outside the Tucson area district. The injunction was dismissed after a judge determined Keschel failed to prove she targeted the right person. In Tempe, police publicly identified the user behind the anonymous Connor Culver Facebook account that for months had rebuked the city's mayor and city manager as corrupt and out of touch. The unveiling came after the account was tagged in a comment by a separate user that city officials interpreted as a threat. Police sought myriad search warrants that ultimately revealed his name. Multiple U.S. Supreme Court opinions have upheld anonymous speech, and legal experts have said unmasking such accounts shouldn't be taken lightly. In the 1995 case McIntyre versus Ohio Elections Commission, a majority of justices described anonymity as a shield from tyranny of the majority. The case dealt with an Ohio law banning anonymous campaign literature. The right to remain anonymous may be abused when it shields fraudulent conduct. But political speech by its nature will sometimes have unpalatable consequences, and in general, our society accords greater weight to the value of free speech than to the dangers of its misuse, the opinion said. The Arizona Republic spoke with both users behind the Connor Culver and William Coffin accounts about why they opt for anonymity and how they feel about efforts to identify anonymous critics. Culver was outed as Stephen Methven, a former Tempe deputy city manager who worked at the city between 2012 and 2022. He no longer uses the anonymous account. Coffin continues to maintain his anonymity. He said he has a background in investigating athletic and financial fraud, but transitioned to exposing fraud and hypocrisy among political figures or influences around 2022. Their responses were edited for length. First question, why did you start posting online? Methven, Connor, Culver, I spent my entire career in government and I had never witnessed elected officials behave in the way I saw elected officials behaving in Tempe. The treatment of residents and in some cases employees were more based on relationships and alliances and personal agendas than they were on professionalism and experience and service. William Coffin, all of my work is basically about lying and hypocrisy. I have an expertise in researching financial stuff, mortgages, bankruptcies, PPP loans, nonprofit fraud, all kinds of stuff. If I encountered a MAGA politician that had pissed me off on Twitter or MAGA influencer who was talking about communism or socialism, sure enough, they'd have two or three bankruptcies. You know, a PPP loan and an FHA mortgage, and this talking about the deep state, right? So when you juxtapose those things, it just becomes interesting for me, and then it becomes interesting for my following. Next question. Why do you opt for anonymity? Methven, having known some of the personalities in charge, I was concerned. I saw it as a necessary safeguard. Government officials do all sorts of things to intimidate and retaliate. I was concerned about the employees that I worked with that were close to me or whom I had promoted, that there would be some sort of retaliation. Coffins respond, mostly death threats. The Arizona Republic replies, really? Coffin states, yes. And because of what I do, you come to realize that anyone can find you at any time, and there's really no safety whatsoever in the social media platforms anymore. Next question. How do you feel about the effort to identify you. Methvin, it just seems like they went to great lengths to uncover something that wasn't that big of a deal in the first place. I'm not saying that making threats against elected officials is not a big deal. Of course it is. But that's just the interpretation of this. I think went a bit too far. Connor Culler responds, Never said anything that was criminal. The city didn't have to release all the information that they did. I think that was meant to intimidate me from ever making any future posts about the city, its leadership, and its working. Coffin's response. The concern has really just risen in lockstep with my concern for the country and free speech and liberty generally. Look at what they did to Jeff. I was kind of sickening. It was kind of sickening that they tried to chill my free speech like that. Anonymous speech is free speech. Jeff Coffin is a Scottsdale man Keshla believed was behind the Coffin account. He had to drive to Tucson May 11th to challenge the injunction against harassment Keshla sought. He said he spent $5,000 to defend himself. The next question, what do you want people to know about your story? Methvin responds, this has never been about embarrassing a city that treated me very well. It's about what I see as a change in the culture in the last few years. It can be corrected and should be corrected. I'm not spending 23 hours a day typing away at a laptop. I'm really not. But when we see what's happening and we do nothing, it gets worse. Coffin's response, I just want the story to be bigger and get out there. I honestly believe you shouldn't be able to live in one district and run in a different one. All I'm doing is searching public records. I tried to stop somebody, a citizen, from saying that. I don't know why it's a bigger story. For both sides of the aisle, you do not care about free speech. And when it comes down to it, most of them don't. That's the chilling part about it. The next item is titled, Horn Has Run His Last Race. This article was written by Alexandra Hartle and Ray Stern of the Arizona Republic. For nearly five decades, Tom Horn helped shape Arizona education and politics as a school board member, legislator, and superintendent and attorney general. A loss in July's Republican primary for state school chief brought that long public career to a close. Horn, 81, lost the Republican nomination in the race to Kimberly Yee by more than 6 percentage points. Yee, 52, is finishing her second term as state treasurer and was due to be termed out when she was tapped by Senator Jake Hoffman last year to compete against Horn. Hoffman had been dissatisfied with Horn's views on implementing some restrictions on the controversial program. Horn chalked his loss up to Yee's endorsement from conservative activism group Turning Point Action. Some voters may choose a Turning Point candidate without paying attention to the candidates themselves, Horn said. And he thinks that may ultimately end up hurting the Republican Party. A number of times, the people they support don't necessarily appeal to independents. And without independents, you cannot win a general election, Horn said. Those concerns have left Horn skeptical about Yee's chances against Democratic nominee Lisa Leyva Ruiz. He noted in an interview with the Arizona Republic that while Republicans make up the single largest share of voters, roughly 65% of Arizona's electorate are not registered with the GOP. And after a bruising primary in which two candidates repeatedly accuse each other of dishonesty, Horn said he does not plan to campaign for his party's nominee. I think I'm going to stay out of it, he said. Horn graduated from Harvard Law School in 1970, the same year the Securities and Exchange Commission accused him and his company, T.C. Horn & Company, of breaking the federal agency's trading rules. In 1973, the agency banned him from trading for life. Horn started a 24-year stint as Paradise Valley School Board member in 1978. He stayed on the board until he handed every one of his children a high school diploma. He changed his party's registration from Democrat to Republican in 1996, and voters elected him to the State House of Representatives in his North Valley district from 1997 to 2000. He lost a bid for the state Senate, then won two terms as school superintendent starting in 2002. Horn's a classically trained pianist and rushed for more arts education in schools. In 2006, his administration launched the AIMS test, which all high school students had to pass before graduating. It was replaced in 2015. He also gave a look at his future role on the job. He authored the law to ban ethnic studies, then used it to end a popular Mexican-American studies program in Tucson. After a lawsuit in 2010, a federal court ruled the law is unconstitutional in 2017, saying it was enacted for racial and political reasons. Horn completed his second term and left the office after voters elected him state attorney general in 2010. In that office, he helped defend Republican issues, including an appearance in the U.S. Supreme Court over a 2004 voter-approved ballot measure that required proof of citizenship to vote. His four-year term was punctuated by a campaign finance investigation that included surveillance by the FBI. During the probe, agents tailing him watched as he got out of his car after hitting a parked vehicle, looked at the damage, then fled the scene with his companion to hide an extramarital affair, according to the FBI at the time. His companion, Carmen Chanel Horn, was a longtime employee he married in 2020 after his wife Martha died. The long-running saga over Horn's 2010 campaign included Horn's denial that he ever coordinated advertising with an independent group, a threat of hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines, and in 2017, a court ruling that the evidence didn't support the allegation. The scandal proved fatal to his 2014 re-election bid, and he was forced to pay $10,000 for unlawfully using his staff to help with his campaign. Horn said he doesn't plan on running for office again, and instead plans to focus his attention on opening a new charter school in Glendale. He got the idea from his wife. 50% of his students will be from high-poverty areas, he said. One of Horn's proudest achievements in his term has been the reinstatement of Project Momentum, which allows Education Department staff members to visit low-performing schools, typically in low-income areas, and look for potential improvements. After the governor's office decided not to continue funding the program, Horn got the Arizona Department of Education to step in. While participation in the program was previously optional, it became mandatory for D-minus and F-minus rated schools not already receiving federal improvement support under Horn's administration. Horn has also been an advocate of upping police presence in Arizona schools, which has been a controversial topic in Arizona for a number of years. Under Horn's administration, the number of police officers in schools increased from 117 to 552. Before Horn leaves office in January, he's committed to opening a new school safety center. There's more to school safety than police officers, he said, citing a state finding that the number of schools were out of compliance in safety measures. Horn could lose some of his legacy when he leaves office. If Ruiz beats Yee in November's general election, she has already pledged to dismantle the hotline that allows people to report school lessons Horn considers inappropriate, such as those including social, emotional learning, or critical race theory. The hotline has generated tens of thousands of prank calls, but no evidence of any investigations. Horn's term coincided with the rise of the state's Universal Empowerment Scholarship Account Program, which provides $7,000 or more of taxpayers' money annually to families that can cover private school tuition and education-related expenses. The program had 11,000 students enrolled in 2022, but in 2026 had over 100,000 students and cost the state over $1 billion a year. Under his leadership, the office struggled to police the program's fraud and abuses, including improper purchases with public money, which the Republic and other news media outlets have covered regularly. A state auditor general report released in May showed the department failed to adequately oversee the program, resulting in likely fraud and abuse. Horn's office criticized the report and auditor general staffers as unfair. The program's rapid growth and repeated controversy helped make school vouchers one of the defining political issues of Horn's tenure. This year, public school advocates collected signatures for a ballot measure that would impose income caps and new regulations on the program. Horn said he has concerns about what will happen to the ESA program if either Yee or Ruiz take office. Yee, he said, could face pressure from Republicans like Hoffman to approve non-educational expenses. If that happens, the ESA program as a whole will lose its credibility and collapse, he said. There will be pressure on her. We'll see what happens if she takes office. If the Democrat takes office, she's going to go be against it anyway, Horn said. Asked about Horn's claim of pressure, Yee said she's focused on problems Horn should have addressed over the past 4 years, while Tom Horn's is apparently focused on concocting outrageous conspiracy theories. Horn said his office will soon be rolling out AI to help audit ESA expenses. Class Wallet, a vendor through which most ESA purchases are made, is developing an AI model. Holmes' agency is simultaneously developing its own model so the two can check each other, he said. Horn reiterated that it is impossible for four employees in his office to adequately oversee the more than $2 million in expenses requests submitted in the past year. Horn said he thinks the AI system will be capable of solving all of the auditing problems if his successor keeps it in place. Horn attributed the misuse in public spending to honest mistakes, disagreeing with a report from the Arizona Auditor General's office. He said the AI will be able to audit the purchases better than the office is currently equipped to do, but that it will take time for the systems to learn. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the August 3rd, 2026 edition of the Arizona Daily Star. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.